This is Hazel Kahn and Tidings, and very pleased to be introducing my guest, Ramzi Barood, well-known Palestinian-American author and activist. He's speaking to me via Skype from Seattle. Ramzi, I read your Al Jazeera piece about growing up as an UNRWA kid in a refugee camp in Gaza. Tell us, how long were you actually in the camp?
22 years, yeah.
Were you born there?
I was born and raised, yes, from a family of refugees that come from southern Palestine. And I was born and raised in the Nusayrat refugee camp. Then I went to Beer Zeit University for a couple of years before I was deported by the Israeli army back to Gaza. And I left when I was 22, 23 years old.
The story that you tell, published in Al Jazeera recently, is built really around the central role that UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency, what that really played in shaping your daily life and your identity. UNRWA has had a higher profile than usual these days because of Trump's decision to abruptly withdraw supporting funds that would help the Palestinian refugees. He just decided to cut that funding. That's the frame within which we're going to be having this conversation. So if you could introduce your story.
I think the way that the story was framed, the story of UNRWA and the American cuts of $350 million that went to badly needed projects that covered the needs of 5 million plus refugees registered with UNRWA, not just in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, but also in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, and elsewhere. Jordan alone has about 40% of all refugees, Palestinian refugees. That's 2.2 million people who are not reliant on government subsidies and funds or anything and anyone else, but rather UNRWA, clinics, hospitals, schools, of course, various types of charities. But the way that the story was framed in the media is that this is a story precisely about charity and nothing else. And what gave that story a lot of credence is the fact that the Trump administration has also cut funds that went to, you know, channeled through other means than UNRWA. For example, they cut $200 million worth of funds that went to various development projects in the West Bank and Gaza. Some of it's channeled through USAID and some of it channeled by other means. But they cut that as well. So the story appeared to be American administration, once more, is trying to twist the arm of the Palestinian leadership in order for them to be forced to negotiate. But it's not really. When it comes to UNRWA, there is a whole new dimension to the story that has been ignored. And what makes it clear that the attack on UNRWA is a different story than just the mere arm twisting that is quite usual in terms of the behavior of American governments and foreign policy, is the fact that Jared Kushner, the son-in-law and top advisor of Trump, went to Jordan in June, and he tried to barter with the king of Jordan, King Abdullah. And he tried to tell him, listen, the money that we are giving UNRWA in Jordan, we will give it to you directly on the condition that those refugees lose the status of being refugees so that we can redefine the status of these people. Now, this is not the matter of collective punishment of the Palestinian people, because Palestinian refugees in Jordan don't really have much political sway over the Palestinian Authority. That's a whole different political context that is related to Jordan and King Abdullah, and all of this has very little to do with Mahmoud Abbas. And if the idea is collective punishment, then why still give the money to the king? So there is something else going on. And that thing is that the U.S. administration under Trump, with the really kind of an effort that's championed not just by Jared Kushner, but by Nikki Haley at the United Nations as well, they are arguing against the principle of the status of Palestinian refugees as defined in international law. If the refugees are no longer refugees, therefore there is no right of return for Palestinian refugees. And if there is no right of return, then there is really very little to be talked about. The two important issues that have been discussed since the beginning of the so-called peace process, 25 years ago or so, has been Jerusalem and the refugees. And Jerusalem is sorted out now, according to Trump's agenda, through the embassy and accepting the Israeli legal status in that city and so forth. And now they are turning all of their energies and efforts at reducing the number of refugees that they are saying, actually, there are only 400,000, there are not 5 million plus. UNRWA is perpetuating the problem because it maintains the status. We need to change it. We need to redefine who is a refugee and who's not. That's why then the story of UNRWA is not a story of a charity. It's a story of identity. And it's a very, very important one to this ongoing drama.
Does this then link back to the story that you wrote about how, in fact, UNRWA, I'm just used to saying UNRWA, gave you your identity in the first place when you were living in the refugee camp, growing up in the refugee camp?
Absolutely. Or not giving us our identity. We chose that identity because nobody wants to be a refugee. I'm not proud of being a refugee. But even though I'm a U.S. citizen now, I still hold on my refugee card. So it's a whole different perception of what a refugee is. So we were born in this situation in which, you know, we have no particular status. We're not quite statusless as of yet. We are not Palestinians in the sense that we have Palestinian IDs and we are living in Palestinian environment and our, you know, identity develops like any normal national identity of any other nation anywhere in the world. And this kind of your normal milieu of, you know, I know who I am, I know where I come from, I know where I live. And where we come from are villages that have been destroyed. We've never been there. We've never seen them. We were born and raised in refugee camps in this kind of, you know, in limbo. We are neither here nor there. We know where we come from, but we can't be there. And we live in places that we don't want to be here. And we are holding tight and waiting and waiting and waiting. UNRWA, for the 70 years since Israel was established on the ruins of Palestinian villages, gave us this kind of temporary status. In fact, when homes were built by UNRWA in the early 50s to house the Palestinian refugees who were mostly living in tents, they were referred to as temporary shelters. That was the official name for them. The whole thing was wrapped in temporariness. The status is temporary. The houses are temporary. The refugee feeding carts are temporary. This is not us. This is not what we want to be. This is not what we aspire for. We are basically on a station waiting for us to be taken to our final destination. The final destination hasn't arrived. 70 years of waiting and nothing has happened because the U.S. and Israel and their allies really worked very, very hard to make sure that this doesn't happen, because they linked the identity of Israel as a Jewish state, and they linked the survival of Israel, and they linked the security, this linked all of these things to the fact that we are waiting at that station to go home. Our very existence and our very aspiration to go home somehow becomes a security threat that will destroy Israel as a Jewish state and so forth and so on. So as a result, we lived in this limbo. We were strong enough, unified enough, clear enough in our minds that we knew who we were, and we refused to let go of this temporary status so that we may achieve the final status. But the final status is not achievable because of the political status quo. So UNRWA really was the platform that created this situation for us. Every morning I would wake up, I would take my UNRWA supplied school books, put them in my UNRWA bag, wear my UNRWA supplied clothes from the clothing center, usually, you know, secondhand worn out clothes and shoes and whatever, and I would go to an UNRWA run school and UNRWA paid teachers, and then during my lunch break I would go to the UNRWA feeding center. We call it the Tome, which means feeding, and we will receive our food rations, we will eat and go back to school and so forth. So in some sense we kind of revolved around the UNRWA concept. UNRWA was a very important part of our daily routine and daily life.
Was it a benign presence or a feared presence? I mean, how did you feel about them?
It was a benign presence in the sense that the vast majority of UNRWA facilities are run by Palestinians. And for a long time, UNRWA was the biggest employer of tens of thousands of Palestinians. So a lot of Palestinians managed to survive because of the money that they are getting from UNRWA. Now, UNRWA has cut 40% of the salaries of all of its employees. I mean, you can imagine what kind of impact this is going to have on the socioeconomics of Gaza and the future of all these families that have really been functioning because of UNRWA. So it was largely a benign presence. I mean, yes, we saw, you know, the, what we refer to as the foreigners, the Westerners, you know, the Norwegian gentleman and the French lady and so forth. And they would come once in a while. You would see them in their cars around the neighborhood, you know, checking on this and that. It's like they existed. They were there. We didn't have any special affinity to them. So many Palestinians complain the salary of a Norwegian executive at UNRWA would be like 40 times as many folds as that of a Palestinian teacher with UNRWA. There is that, and there have been many strikes against UNRWA. But it's like almost like as if it's an internal matter. There was the UNRWA beach. That's where the UNRWA compound, and as kids from Gaza, we were not allowed to go to that beach. It bothered us, but it wasn't so fundamental that we felt like we were at war with UNRWA. And this is why when I wrote my article for Al Jazeera, arguing how UNRWA willingly or unwittingly has provided us with that alternative identity that kept our hope and dream of going home alive and gave us the legal structure that continued to breathe life in UN Resolution 194 regarding the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Otherwise, it would have been forgotten, something that happened 70 plus years ago. Who cares anymore? UNRWA is the organization that kept honoring that resolution, giving it value, meaning on a daily basis through functioning and operating within the Gaza Strip.
So did they also define the syllabus for the school children so that you were reminded or did not forget your Palestinian history?
Well, that's another tricky part here, because UNRWA had to operate under Israeli occupation. So all the school curriculum had to pass through Israeli censors. So we were not actually allowed to learn our own history. We were never at any stage in my life, from the kindergarten until high school, been really told in any written form that you are a Palestinian and this is the map of your country. Never. And wouldn't be allowed. So what happened is that the Palestinian UNRWA teachers secretly taught us our own history. And I remember whenever they want to say anything related to Palestine, you know, we'd all look around, you know, outside just to make sure that nobody is creeping. And then they would close the door and whisper.
Would they refer to it as Palestine, Palestine, I guess, in Arabic? Or was it like a code name?
No, they would talk about Palestine. This is where you guys come from. That's the kind of history you've had. This is where your ancestors lived. These are the villages. They would ask us about what village you come from, Ramzi. And I would say, I come from Beit Daras. And they would say, mashallah, the people of Beit Daras, known for being courageous and brave. So it kind of really did cement a sense of identity, even though at times happened secretly. And this is why in the article I argued about the non-UNRWA sanctioned flag coloring day.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Very touching.
Of course, they knew what we were doing.
Describe that for our listeners. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, in the first week of every school year, at one point, there is this large blue and white truck, UNRWA truck, would pull in. They would go to all the schools, and we never know what day specifically they would arrive, because it depends on how quickly they manage to get their work done. They will be carrying books, notebooks, coloring books, crayons, pencils, pens, and so forth and so on. So we would be like on edge for the first few days. You know, every time you see a big truck, all the children would kind of look to the street and it's like, oh, the UNRWA truck. Oh, no, it's not. Oh, the UNRWA truck. No, it's not. And then the UNRWA truck would actually pull in and you would hear all the kids screaming all at once, cheering in excitement and joy. And then, you know, the UNRWA employees, and they would carry the big boxes. And, you know, if the budget is doing well, you know, we might actually get more than usual. But oftentimes the budget was not doing great.
Ramzi Baroud is talking about growing up in a Palestinian refugee camp. This is Tidings on WPKN Radio.
So it's usually used books, torn books. The crayon box is never full. It had space for about 8. But they always give us 4 because the budget is not very good. You want to get all the colors of the Palestinian flags. You need to get to the red and the black and the green. And of course, the white would be in the background of the coloring book. But you never get that. Sometimes you get black, your friend is getting green, and so forth. So we all start kind of exchanging. Who has green? And someone would raise his hand. Ahmed has green. Muhammad has this. Salim has that. And somehow we'll all manage to color our Palestinian flags on a piece of paper on the first day, the first act that we do is this kind of collective act of defiance and pride that is taken by all the children all at once. Nobody would color anything else. The first act has to be a Palestinian flag. They would give us these kind of empty, you know, art books, like just blank white papers, and we will draw our flags on the empty white page, and then we will tear it, and sometimes we'll find a little stick, and we will glue the stick to the flag, and we will all raise our Palestinian flags. And we knew that the Israelis also knew. They would be like hiding in various parts and corners, street corners and so forth, waiting and having us line up and take our books and open them to show them that we don't have a flag. And we knew that, yet everybody of us has actually done it, despite the fact if you are caught, you are taken to what we call the tents. The tents is the Israeli army encampment in an area that is adjacent to my refugee camp near the main Gaza highway. And in the process, you will be beaten, you will be slapped in the face, you'll be humiliated. And it depends on your age. You could actually serve time in jail, or your parents could be dragged in, and they will be humiliated and beaten, and then they would have to pay fees to get you out. But we did it anyway. I did it like everybody else, every single year.
Do you, by any chance, still have one of those flags?
I don't think so, because when I left my house in Gaza, all my school stuff were left behind, and that house was actually bombed in the various wars. So I don't think there's anything left, really.
Give me just some dates now. You were born when, if I may ask?
I was born in July 1972.
1972. And then you said you left the camp in 94 then, 22?
Yes, exactly.
Until the funds were withdrawn, which was recent. Did the same thing continue? Is there still a Nusrat camp?
If there is still a Nusrat camp, I think for a short period of time after Oslo, there was this attempt at redefining the names of the camps, and it completely failed. Basically, everything to stay exactly as it was, except instead of calling Mukhayyam al-Nusayrat, the Nusayrat refugee camp, let's call it Beldat al-Nusayrat, the Nusayrat town. Nobody ever used that terminology, and eventually it evaporated.
What was the purpose of renaming?
Because they wanted to tell the people, forget about the right of return. As long as it's called a refugee camp, there is a right of return. If it becomes something else, it means that the settlement is going to happen here. No right of return. Whatever this place you are living in, feel comfortable. It's going to be the place and nothing else. It is still a refugee camp because there are refugees receiving refugee rations from UNRWA. And so, to the contrary, since I left, the role of UNRWA has been accentuated even more. 2005, the Israelis redeployed. They left the center of Gaza and they went to the border areas. And then they, per international law, per the Fourth Geneva Convention in particular, Israel is responsible for the welfare of occupied Palestinians. Now, Israel says it's not responsible for Gaza anymore. And not just that, it's preventing Gazans through this hermetic siege of 11 years plus to actually have any economic potential, to travel, to be free, to achieve the good education and so forth in order for them to actually survive. If UNRWA was important during my years in Gaza, it became the only lifeline for many, many Palestinian families. My dad worked. I mean, he worked as a cheap laborer in Israel, like most Palestinian men. But UNRWA was this kind of nice little thing, you know. At least he knew that his kids' schooling is provided by UNRWA. At least we knew that once a month we are going to go to the center of, you know, where they provide clothes donated by various countries, and we are going to find a jacket and boots and that sort of thing. But now, for many, many Palestinian families, especially those who became homeless after their houses were destroyed in the 2014 war, UNRWA is the only lifeline. So if you eradicate UNRWA, there is nothing for them, absolutely nothing.
So has it already been implemented, this fund?
they are able to see this impact now in Jordan and in Gaza, among other places, because they are the ones that are most vulnerable. Now, already the working hours at the various UNRWA clinics in Jordan have been slashed dramatically. In Gaza, the hundreds of people have been fired from their jobs. Those who don't have permanent UNRWA employment and they are on contracts for many years, they all have been fired, and the remaining ones had their salaries cut by 40%. So we already see this happening, and it will continue to happen until the issue is permanently resolved.
What percentage of people are in fact employed by UNRWA in Gaza?
Well, I don't know the exact number. I know that at one point it was the largest employer. Even before the U.S. cut its share from the budget was almost never met 100%. So there's always deficits. That's why we always got, you know, half box of crayons. And this is not the kind of an organization that can simply say it's better to operate on a tighter, you know, leaner budget. This is not a business model. It's a charity model. You have hundreds of schools, hundreds of clinics, and various other services, and they never actually meet the need. The need is still greater than what was already provided, so they merely meet the absolute minimum of those needs.
The business model would be austerity, austerity to the limit.
Exactly. So imagine a situation in which austerity is happening in UNRWA. It means that someone is not going to be fed. A child is not going to go to school. This is not a business model. It's a charity model. Someone is going to pay the price for that.
Ramzi, so the right to return is this imperative. It is the Palestinian imperative. It's the existential imperative. Just like Zionism, the imperative is to get everybody out of there except the Jews. That's the equal imperative. What it's always been is erasure, erasing the Palestinians. When you told me about renaming the camps, it reminded me about how they renamed all the Arab villages. You said there's 600 Arab villages, right? So those, that's one of the things they did, is to rename them and to take away any signs of it. Now they're also erasing Arabic as one of the two official languages of Israel. And, you know, it's the model. I don't really want to say this. You know, it is the Nazi model, to just get rid of people.
Bravo. That's exactly what it is.
It's the Nazi model. It just is. And now they're squeezing Gaza by just taking away the money so that people can't eat or live.
Bravo. But you know, a lot of people, when they engage in this conversation, they don't frame it this way. They think that when we talk about the right of return, we are basically talking about this kind of the technicality. You have 5 million Palestinian refugees who are going to be taking their bags and going back and rebuilding their lives. What the right of return represents is it presents the only element of justice that remains in this conflict. Anything else is just sorting it out in Israel's favor. The fact that we are holding on the right of return, regardless of whether I am ready to leave Seattle and go back to Beit Daras tomorrow, that's not the point. The last component that would give our struggle its drive for justice. Because if you say no to the right of return, then we have nothing to fight for. We have lost our identities. We have lost our land, of course, and our villages. And we have even lost the last resemblance of any justice ever being served. How the right of return is to be implemented and how many Palestinian refugees are willing to go or not to go, that's an issue that has to be sorted out in accordance to the aspirations of the Palestinian people and international law. So we're not being stubborn. We're not being unrealistic, as the Israelis and many try to portray us, that this is an old thing and forget about it. But they fear that as long as we talk about the right of return, as long as we are changing that Zionist notion that this land belongs to the Jews and to the Jews only and nobody else, and as long as we are fighting for the right of return, as long as we are challenging the Zionist notion regarding the identity of this land between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. So the meanings here are very, very loaded. And it's not about us being stubborn, us fully understanding the nature of the Zionist project.
There's no coexistence between these two imperatives, the right of return and the right to remain, I guess.
Well, actually, there is. I mean, as far as the Palestinian formula is concerned, we demand the right of return, and right of return, capital R, because it's the actual name granted by the United Nations to describe the process of repatriation and the process of going back to our homes. And according to UN resolutions pertaining to the right of return, the idea is for Palestinians to return and to live peacefully with their neighbors. That's what it says. And we don't contend with that. When we argue for the right of return, we don't say, and in the process, we are going to massacre everybody else who lives there. That's really never been in the offing. It's never been part of our collective thinking. So I don't see a reason of why coexistence between Palestinians and Arabs and Jews and Christians and Muslims, why can't that be the premise upon which we build the future of this country, as opposed to that in which one is superior and nobody else belongs there?
The right of return. I wonder whether you worry that the new generations are forgetting the right of return. The reason I was asking is because I was very impressed when the American embassy was put there in Jerusalem, and then the Great March of Return that started, I think, that same time, simultaneously. Is that right?
That's right, exactly. And I want to say, no, I'm not worried about the young generation forgetting. And I think the reason of why I'm not terribly worried is that because Israel is constantly reminding us of the right of return. You see, if Israel, perhaps from a Zionist perspective, tried to create a livable environment for Palestinians instead of the slaughter that happened in Gaza just recently. I mean, the fact that there is this violent campaign that never stopped, this, you know, the attempt at redefining the refugees, depriving them from the very tent and the very basic medication and education that's keeping them alive, it reminds us what the issue is all about. So I'm not worried because the Palestinians are not forgetting, and because the Zionist mentality is so hell-bent on reminding us, because of this continued campaign, this continued ethnic cleansing and genocide that's been happening for 70 years. But I also want to say that there are many people who are attempting to make us forget. When the likes of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, when he was asked by Israeli television where he comes from, and he goes, "I come from Safed." Safed is a very beautiful Palestinian city in today's northern Israel. But then he follows that by saying, "But I have no interest of ever going back." So when you have the president of the country dishonoring the right of return, then you know that there are attempts really at pushing Palestinians to forget it. Perhaps one of the biggest challenges that exist in the Palestinian community right now is between those who are still holding on the right of return and those who renders it as irrelevant and unachievable. And let's look past it into something entirely different.
I'm just trying to think of a way to end our conversation. This is an ongoing discussion, conversation. So I would like to be able, you know, to call on you whenever the next thing happens or whenever things seem to be changing, to get your views on what's happening.
I'm more than happy, Hazel, to chat with you. It's always quite exciting, actually.
Good.
The nature of your questions and all of this. I like
thank
our
you.
Chats. And
yeah, me too. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So thank you very much, Ramzi Baroud, for this conversation. And we look forward to the next one. That was Ramzi Baroud talking about Palestinian refugees, UNRWA, and the right of return. Our recent conversation about the role of women in Palestinian society is online at hazelkahn.com. Ramzi Baroud's writings on Palestine, Gaza, and UNRWA can be found at ramzibaroud.net. You can hear Tidings on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. All Tidings programs are archived on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.